KZSU-FM Stamford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stamford Law School. Thank you for joining today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Margot Kaminsky. Margot is a research scholar and executive director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Margot is doing terrific work on a variety of areas right now, but our focus today is going to be on her work involving capture of the regulatory process, particularly that involving international intellectual property and the U.S. Trade Representative's office, involving questions of U.S. trade and particularly the current ongoing negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The article that we're going to talk about, which is a draft article but has and will be forthcoming in USC's Law Review, is the capture of international intellectual property law through the U.S. trade regime. This is a topic that we've discussed on Hearsay Culture on occasion with several guests, including Mike Geist from Ottawa and others who have focused on this broad question of how law is being made at the international level. Because of Hearsay Culture's focus on IP and technology, we have drilled down on that topic, but there are even broader questions at stake. When we're thinking about lawmaking in 2013, information flow issues become paramount, not only because of the now very well understood and widely known concept that the Internet allows for free flow of information, but also more specifically because it changes our expectations as to what information will be available and when. So the topic of transparency and really of capture is one that's front and center today. Capture is a concept, of course, that goes back for decades in the works of people like Kahn and others who focus on how administrative entities and regulatory entities make their decisions. And the notion of capture, which is something we're going to talk about on the show today, boils down to, although Margot will give it much more context and meaning in our discussion, boils down to the concept that sometimes there will be situations where certain industries and certain interests have undue or have too much or more than we would consider fair or just outsized influence. Influence over how decisions are made, influence on regulations, influence on lawmaking. This particular issue is now amplified in importance because at the international level, a lot of law is being made or is being purported to be made involving questions of intellectual property. And this concept of what information should be available on the Internet, what information, if it's accessed or if it's made available, will be considered infringing on intellectual property rights like copyright and patent and so forth, is at the core of the questions that we've had today with regard to the Internet. And whether it's one of our initial guests and the founder of CIS, Larry Lessig, with whom I talked about this back in 2006, or any number of guests over the last 7 years, we have focused heavily on Hearsay Culture on the question of what information should we have access to, what information we shouldn't have access to, who should have access to it, and what should the law say about it. And if there's any defining concept on Hearsay Culture and a theme that I've tried to present over the last 7+ years, it has been that. So now Margot's work, which is exceptionally important, not only because of the practical implications of making these decisions right now, as we're going to talk about in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, but also theoretically as we think about what should be available, is something that I'm really excited to have Margot on today to discuss. So like I said, by way of very brief background, she is a research scholar in law and the executive director of the Information Society Project at Yale. She graduated from Harvard University and Yale Law School. She's been a fellow at ISP for quite a while. I got to know Margot through ISP and through her work. I'm an admirer of her work, and I look forward to continuing to work with her now and in the future. She clerked for the Honorable Andrew Kleinfeld of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. She has had a variety already of fellowships, and she's been a Google Policy Fellow at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so she is a wonderful guest to have on today. She is joining us via Skype on October 30th. We're airing today from her apartment in Westchester County, New York, not far from where I grew up. Margot, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor.
So let's start off, Margot, with a question that I ask most of my guests, which is tell us a bit more about your background and why you became interested in this topic of regulatory capture and international lawmaking.
So this is actually a rather roundabout journey for me. I started my exposure to copyright law when I was working for a literary agency in New York and saw the copyright contracts that were coming through for agreements between authors and publishers. And at that point in time, the digital market was really only just starting to take off, so I got to see the effects of the digital environment on the kind of deals that were being struck between authors and publishers. And so this interest in digital copyright led me eventually to short stints at both Creative Commons and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I started to recognize, particularly when I was a fellow at EFF, that a lot of the debates that were happening domestically around digital copyright had very close parallels occurring in the international space. And much of what was going on in domestic copyright was appearing in really strange ways in the international space. So I started looking in great detail at the trade agreements that the U.S. was negotiating bilaterally with other countries to see what forms specifically of digital copyright protection were being included in those agreements.
And so when we're talking about these issues, and like I mentioned in your introduction, we have discussed these issues on occasion on Hearsay Culture with regard to trade. Perhaps you can offer some context here. When we think about international trade, issues involving intellectual property are not necessarily the ones that immediately come to mind. So for those that aren't familiar, explain to us in broad terms what the international trade lawmaking process is and how IP issues come up.
Right. So I think this is something that is really counterintuitive to a lot of people, and I want to try to get across what intellectual property law is doing in trade. The main justification for including intellectual property law in trade is this idea that having different legal systems governing different kinds of IP internationally creates trade barriers between countries. So I know you had Anupam Chander on recently talking about trade law or trade that occurs through the Internet. One of the potential hurdles to having trade occur online is that you have different legal regimes in different countries, and so that creates costs for the firms that want to export products to other countries. So there are two different kinds, really, of integration that you can do in international trade. One is called negative integration, where you try to lower barriers between countries by reducing things like tariffs or other, you know, obvious discriminations by countries against foreign goods. And the other kind of integration is called positive integration, and that's when you make laws that match the laws of other countries so that you lower the legal hurdles to countries that want to export goods abroad. IP is justified for inclusion in the trade regime in large part because it would lower those legal costs, and so is a form of positive integration rather than negative integration.
So let's think about this, again, for the uninitiated, about
sure.
What the process, in fact, is, right? So I mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. It's an agreement that involves international trade. It's purported to be a hallmark of the Obama administration's efforts. But again, for the uninitiated, what is TPP, which is going to be, and I'll use an acronym, which is the context through which we'll have this discussion?
Right. So I need to give some historical background, mm-hmm. again, for where IP has already appeared in the international trade regime. So back in the 90s, and actually somewhat prior to that, there was this big push internationally. In large part, it was credited to a number of developed countries to try to raise the level of international IP protection to make sure it was easier for some U.S. countries to export IP goods abroad. So in the agreement on trade-related aspects of IP, the TRIPS agreement at the World Trade Organization, a number of countries proposed things and other countries agreed to them that raised the level of IP protections internationally. So since TRIPS, the agreement on trade-related aspects of IP at the World Trade Organization, there have been a lot of splinterings of where international IP should go next. And the developing countries, for the large part, have looked to different international bodies, such as the UN, where they can try to focus on the human rights aspects of IP or the public health aspects of IP. By contrast, the developed countries, such as the United States and the countries in the EU, have splintered off into agreements such between them and one other country, so bilateral agreements, or between them and a number of other countries, to try to raise the levels of IP outside of these human rights and public health contexts. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is an example of one of these kinds of agreements. It's between the U.S. and I forget the exact number of other countries, But they're countries scattered across Southeast Asia and South America, and including the United States. And the idea there is to raise IP to what the Obama administration is referring to as a 21st century level of protection.
So now I'm glad you used that phrase, because I referred to it. 21st century level of protection. I don't want to parse political statements too closely on the show, but that is fraught with all kinds of implications in terms of what we mean by way of lawmaking. So when I'm asking this as a personal opinion, when you hear or read the phrase 21st century agreement, what does that mean? What does that mean to us? What should that mean to the public? Again, in terms of this context of trade.
Right. So you would think that a 21st century agreement that is talking about intellectual property law would, to some extent, talk about the digital environment. And it's correct that the bilateral agreements the U.S. has been negotiating, and at least the leaked draft of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, do contain chapters that refer to intellectual property in the digital environment.
Meaning what?
What those chapters actually do.
Right. And that's going to get us to this question of really, you know, it's both process, but of course, as anyone who's taken civil procedure or remembers civil procedure knows, process and substance are often difficult to untangle. And what you're focusing on here in this piece, and we're chatting with Margo Kaminsky of Yale's Information Society Project on KZCU FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture, the capture of international intellectual property law. So I want to define a few more terms before we get into the thesis of your paper and what's going on here. Capture is one that, again, has a lot of different meanings, but as you use the word capture, what does that mean? How do you define it?
So capture can involve a bunch of different kinds of mechanisms, and I'm most interested in a particular mechanism that I've noticed at play in the U.S. Trade Representative's office. When people think of capture, they often think of incentives. So they think about people who work for government agencies who are incentivized to regulate in ways that benefit the companies or individuals that they are regulating, because they're either offered jobs in those industries, or there's some kind of, you know, payoff of some kind, or there's lobbying money. What's really interesting about what's going on at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative is that, to some extent, that traditional form of capture occurs. There's a good deal of evidence of a revolving door problem between people who work at the USTR and some of the companies that are, you know, impacted by what the USTR does. But what's much more interesting to me, in large part because of the context you gave at the beginning of this, is the information flow. And I focus in large part in this project on trying to figure out how information gets to the USTR and what the USTR does with that information.
And so that, again, gets us to this broad question. And I'm going to ask one more foundational question, Margo, before we get into some of the points that you're making in the article. The U.S. Trade Representative, right, is not an office that it comes up regularly in the press, right? You're not going to put on CNN or The Daily Show even, or Colbert or Fox News, and hear about the U.S. Trade Representative. And yet the U.S. Trade Representative's office is playing a very significant role in crafting what law will look like here. Give us a bit of the history, and again, I know that I could say give me the history and leave, and we'll come back 40 minutes from now and we could have more history, but in a couple of minutes, or even more, 3 or 4 minutes, tell us a bit about who the USTR is, right, and both individually and as an institution, and what role it plays in all of this.
So the USTR, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, is part of the Executive Office of the President, and I believe it was initially created in the 1960s, but the statute that I'm most interested in is this 1974 statute that established how trade gets negotiated from the U.S. side of things. And in that 1974 statute, which is referred to as establishing trade promotion authority or fast-track trade negotiations, there are a number of things that the Congress did that make the USTR into a really interesting agency, and change the way that the USTR operates compared to other agencies, administrative agencies in the United States. But what the USTR is basically supposed to do is go to international negotiations on behalf of the United States and negotiate free trade agreements.
And free trade agreements being the everything from NAFTA, right, something that, that got a lot of press about 20, 30 years ago, to more narrow agreements like how many cars should be traded between the United States and South Korea, correct?
Yes, and what's interesting about these agreements, I think this is in large part why people don't tend to look at them closely, mm-hmm. is that they include chapter upon chapter of really, really detailed lawmaking. So the chapter that I'm looking at, the chapters that I look at, involve intellectual property law. There are also chapters on agriculture or on textiles or telecom. And that makes it really difficult to find what's going on there because there is so much law.
Mm-hmm. And so there it is, right, in a nutshell. We've got a lot of law being made, right, or a lot of law being debated, right, and negotiated, and then potentially, as you alluded to, and we won't get too far into the weeds, but at one point or another, someone at the U.S. domestic side has to decide that this is going to, in fact, have currency and be enforceable in the U.S. But even before we get to that, there's a lot of discussion about what the law looks like. And like, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I've had Mike Geist and a few others on the show who talk about these issues. But at the core of the problem, right, this capture issue involves the information flow. So what is the status right now of what the public knows about TPP? And then secondarily, and as we will talk about, are there any entities like, for example, certain entities involved in the trade regulatory advising process who might get special access? So it's a question that is at the core of this issue. But before we even talk about your thesis and your take on it, what is the status right now of what we know and what certain industries might know about this area?
So the very short answer is mm-hmm. the public officially knows nothing. It's actually been going on since around 2002. The USTR has been classifying all trade negotiating documents and not releasing negotiating drafts of these trade agreements, including the intellectual property chapters, for examination by anybody in the public, which includes public interest groups such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Public Knowledge, KEI, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the answer to the other half of your question is that while the public sees nothing about these agreements, the USTR has advisory committees, three levels of advisory committees, and these advisory committees do have access to the text of the agreements and provide input to the USTR on what they think should be in these agreements.
So by way of disclosure, right, so, and as you know, so I have written in this area involving transparency in international trade. Of course, the focus of the show is not my work, but rather yours. But by way of disclosure, I have taken positions on this, both in advocacy and in articles. But my goal here, putting on the journalism hat, is to ask the questions and focus. So with that in mind, right, turning to the work that you're doing, right, we have this regime that you write about, and this regime is one that involves a rather complex form of what you might call advise and consent, right? We've got these regulatory panels called industry trade advisory committees, right? And those committees are identified by subject area. So there's an IP, there's an intellectual property committee, and there are committees in other areas. This gets about as weedy and administrative as we're going to get on the show, but I think it's critical to this discussion. Tell us a bit about these, and I'll use the acronyms, ITACs. What are the ITACs, and what is it that they're doing?
So I want to provide some context for why I got interested in the mm-hmm. ITACs as I'm describing what it is that they're doing.
Sure.
A large part of the focus and of your focus in this area, which has been really valuable for opening the doors to this discussion, has been on the application of the Freedom of Information Act to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. So as I mentioned earlier, the USTR has classified most of its trade negotiations, and the executive branch has rubber-stamped that and said, yes, we're fine with you classifying this. So a number of years ago, when public interest groups were trying to get access to the texts of these trade agreements, they were turned down in the Freedom of Information Act process and told, this is actually, you can't see these agreements because it's a matter of national security. So that raised a lot of flags for a lot of people. And the reason I got interested in looking at the ITACs was because of this information disparity between what the public interest groups could see and what the public could see, and what the members of these advisory committees could see. So that led me to a completely different law, which governs, it's also an open government law, but it governs the relationship between government agencies and advisory committees. Mm-hmm. And what that law does usually, it's called the Federal Advisory Committee Act. For most agencies in the U.S., it requires that if you're going to have an advisory committee made up of people from the industries you regulate, you can only have that committee for, I think, 4 years at a time. That committee has to consist of balanced membership of people from a variety of different perspectives, and there are transparency requirements. So these industry trade advisory committees that work with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative are not subject to most of slash almost all of those requirements.
And so these requirements, right, get us into what is at the core of your paper, right? We talk about, and again, we're chatting with Margo Kaminsky of Yale's Information Society Project on KZSU Stanford and Hearsay Culture, right? These committees are part of this larger question of capture that you talk about, how U.S. trade itself and the U.S. trade regime, as you identify it, are impacting law in this area. You mentioned fast track, right? And this is a big focus of your paper, and it's something that, again, And you know, particularly because we're dealing with a very critical but not often discussed area that is trade, and certainly not a heavy focus of Hearsay Culture, though an important one, we're defining a number of terms. Right? So there are different ways that international agreements can become enforced in the United States and in other countries. But obviously, we could spend the next 10 hours talking about other countries and how they do things. We'll focus only on the U.S. for purposes of our discussion. What is fast track, and then more broadly, how is it that an international trade agreement would traditionally become law or enforceable in the United States?
So fast track is this interesting process. This is the 1974 law I was referring to earlier. Mm-hmm. That basically is a compromise between the executive branch and Congress on making an easier way to make international law. The usual way that duties are divided in international lawmaking in the U.S. Is through the Article II clause on treaty making, which requires, it allows the president to go and negotiate things, but it requires ratification from two-thirds of the Senate. And that's an extraordinarily burdensome process. International law scholars, for the most part, point out that this prevents a lot of international law from getting made. Because in addition to having two-thirds of the Senate approve your treaty, you also have to have Congress enact a law that makes that treaty operational within the United States for most treaties. So fast track was this bargain between the executive branch and Congress that said, we're going to depart from that because we really need to make trade law. Historically, trade has been a huge component of economic development in the United States. The Great Depression was actually in part linked to the U.S. being isolationist and cutting itself off from other countries and ending trade, enacting huge barriers. So Congress decided in 1974, we're going to let the executive branch go and negotiate these trade agreements to benefit our economy. And when they come back to us, we're going to tie our own hands deliberately to make it easier for these things to pass. So when the executive branch hands us these things, these agreements, we ourselves get to just vote up and down, up or down, on whether we are okay with these agreements. And we're not allowed to amend them in any way.
So this is fascinating, right? Because I think, you know, certainly colloquially, right, I think, right, and I'm saying this half facetiously, right, the Constitution says something about how these decisions are made. But fast track is something different. And you mentioned the tying of the hands, which I think is critically important in your work and also gets to this capture issue that we're going to drill down on after a short break. So when you say tying the hands, what exactly, exactly is probably too strong. What does that mean in terms of the decision-making process, right? Once the agreement comes out of, right, the negotiating partner. So as it stands right now, right, TPP has been negotiated for several years. There's been a number of rounds of negotiation, right? As far as we know, and as you mentioned, officially we know nothing, but at least with regard to press releases, which are official, right, there seems to be an indication that things have moved along, that maybe they're close to being done. There are still some sticking points. But once an agreement is reached, once the negotiating representatives of the 12 or so countries are negotiating say, this is our agreement, what happens at that point, both under fast track and traditionally?
So traditionally, once they say this agreement is done, you would bring this back and you'd have to get 2/3 of the Senate to say, great, this agreement is ratified.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this area, if there were any differences between the agreement and U.S. law, you would also have to convince Congress to pass an act implementing them. Under fast track, you skip that Senate 2/3 majority hurdle, and you also don't really in the same way have to go to Congress and say that they need to enact things, because what Congress is supposed to do is just say yes or no to the agreement, and they can't try to change the agreement and make you go back to the negotiating table, which in the traditional process you could do.
Mm-hmm. And so what will happen effectively, right, under fast track is that public input and public understanding may be diminished. Is that fair? Or is that overstating it?
So I think it overstates it somewhat, and mm-hmm. this is actually why I found my own positions shifting a little bit during mm-hmm. this process mm-hmm. and got really interested in what was going on the micro level in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative.
Mm-hmm.
So the again, traditional stance among a number of constitutional law scholars and international law scholars is that fast track is not that bad. I think coming from my perspective of looking at the IP portions of these agreements, I started by thinking, yeah, fast track is really terrible,
mm-hmm.
because I want to, you know, be able to talk about the substance of these agreements and get Congress to weigh in if the substance is bad. But reverting to an Article 2 treaty negotiating process would historically killed international lawmaking. And as Anupam Chander again pointed out, some international lawmaking may be necessary for the digital economy and digital civil liberties to actually work internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm less prone to say that we should go back to an Article 2 treaty process, but it prompted me to think really hard about what it is that the people who write about fast track are missing. And I think the answer really is information flow.
So that gets us to what we're going to talk about after our break, which is at the core of your paper. So we're chatting with Margo Kaminsky of Yale's Information Society Project on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue listening. So, Margo, let's turn now to all of this foundational material, but that's the risk you run when you start talking about international trade and IP in a world that is increasingly focusing on it, but still is not quite up to speed. Because if you picked, say, copyright fair use as a topic, we would have been getting into the weeds almost immediately, but there's been more writing about it. So now I'm going to ask you the most academic question that I ask of any of our authors, but you're in good company when you get it. What is the thesis of your article, which is forthcoming in USC's Law Review, The Capture of International Intellectual Property Law Through the U.S. Trade Representative? There you go.
The thesis of my article is that the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative is subject to information capture. It is subject to information flow that is different from the kinds of information that goes into IP lawmaking in the domestic U.S. space. And as a consequence, the language of the IP chapters of free trade agreements that USTR negotiates skews, it distorts in really interesting and possibly troubling ways.
Okay, so now we can talk about, right, that process in more detail, right? From a top level, right, when you look at these issues, and there are scholars and others who have written about this, right, at a top level, we could say or argue, well, look, to the extent that there is capture, right, meaning to the extent that the information flow is skewed in a way that leads to bad results, right, a solution would be not having the USTR, right, not having the U.S. Trade Representative be the entity negotiating on behalf of the United States, or more specifically, although it gets trickier even here, for U.S. interests, right, and put intellectual property into another space, right? And there are traditional spaces for this kind of negotiation, right? We have the World Intellectual Property Organization. We have perhaps even the World Trade Organization. Oh, that sounds counterintuitive, but the World Trade Organization is an institution, whereas TPP has been negotiated in kind of a freestanding way. We could go through the UN and so forth. So let's talk about that argument or that problem. What is your opinion about removing intellectual property entirely, right, from the trade regime and therefore perhaps sidestepping entirely the issue of capture?
Right. So as you'll know, if you spoke to Michael Geist or Peter Yu or a number of other people who are working in this space, the international institutions in which these things get negotiated, these IP agreements or IP-related law gets negotiated, vary widely in how much participation you can have on an international level. So one, if you propose removing intellectual property law from trade, the idea is that international IP would get negotiated, again, in places internationally that are more receptive to human rights issues, to public health issues, and allow for more participation on the international level. What I find really interesting about my own project, which is an unfair thing to say, is that I'm looking really at how international law gets made domestically, right? So I'm looking from the U.S. perspective, what goes into what the U.S. puts on the negotiating table in these international fora. And I actually don't think it makes that much of a difference as long as the USTR is involved, which international forum we start negotiations at. So if the USTR is involved with negotiating international IP law and walks into the UN, it's likely to still be reflecting the interests of those industries that are capturing it. It just will be reflecting them at the UN, where public interest groups can push back more. And so this idea of taking intellectual property out of trade and removing it from the USTR's grasp is really appealing in some ways. I think that historically we've entwined IP with trade so strongly that it's a practical matter, it's going to be impossible to do.
Well, that kind of gets at what is a very thorny issue, right? And to, you know, to push back a little bit on that idea, the fact of the matter is, right, as it stands today, that every government asserts this, right, and I think there's data to back it up. If there are major exports that are coming out of the United States, it is informational, right? I mean, Google, right, would be a classic example of it, but it's not just that, right? I mean, the notion, and Anupam Chander in his book, The Electronic Silk Road, talks about this. We've moved from a goods to a services trade regime. And what that means is, right, that intellectual property law, right, rules about who can access what information and how it can be used are paramount in trade. So how do you remove, or what is your response to an argument saying that you simply cannot remove intellectual property law and concepts from the trade regime because it is now arguably more important than ever that trade negotiating partners and countries that trade with each other talk about these issues?
I think that's exactly right, actually. As long as the trade negotiating process allows for input by multiple parties, it does make sense to a certain extent, given Anupam's arguments that IP law is trade law or e-commerce law is trade law at this point, that we include these things in trade agreements. So one way to illustrate this is that, you know, you've talked a lot in the past about Communications and Decency Act Section 230, mm-hmm. which is, you know, allows for an exemption from liability for a lot of the Silicon Valley companies so that they can build new business models and not get sued. And this has widely, Anupam has written about this, other people have too, it's widely been credited with allowing for Silicon Valley's growth. Well, you would think that if these companies are the ones that are really strongly involved in exports in the United States, that we would have a CDA 230 section in free trade agreements because we would want other countries to establish similar law to lower the costs and trade barriers for our companies to do work abroad. Mm-hmm. But that's not in them. So I think that speaks to the CDA 230 example, speaks to the difference between me and Anupam, as much as I really like his work, is that Anupam is a trade optimist, and I am a bit of a trade realist. So while I recognize that internet law and trade are intimately entwined, or potentially intimately entwined, the actual institutions that are involved in trade lawmaking at this point prevent us from being able to execute Anupam's vision.
So I'm not going to attempt to play the role of Anupam Chander or Professor Chander on Hearsay Culture, but I'll push back a little bit from this perspective. So you mentioned CDA 230, and that it has been a topic on Hearsay Culture, but for those that didn't hear those shows or don't remember, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act broadly protects information service providers, or as Eric Goldman would call them, information access providers, and I tend to agree that you want to talk about semantics, it's probably a better way to approach it, but the point is that Section 230 protects those intermediaries for information, the hosts of information platforms, the Googles, the Facebooks, and so forth, from liability for things like defamation, for the speech itself, so long as they're not speakers themselves, which gets into the weeds of 230 that we don't have to get into here. Basically, the idea is, if you're a platform for speech, you can be a platform for speech without getting sued if someone says something else that someone doesn't like. Okay, so it's a very powerful protection for speech, right? 230 and the ethic behind it really does, it seem, fly in the face of, right, the idea that information should be held by certain entities and not by others when, in fact, law is being made. Isn't it fair to say that Section 230, right, and the fact that, to be clear, right, the United States has been not, it's not just our law, but we have, I think, and I'm speaking personally now, in a positive way, right, attempted to export that concept, right, to other countries, to use a trade term, isn't that very much a pushback such that the optimism, right, is equally realistic? So again, I'm saying this as me, questioner, I'm not taking the role of Professor Chander, but what do you say to that counter-argument? In other words, the argument being that perhaps Section 230 is, and those ideas are, in fact, more powerful than we give them credit for here.
I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
Sorry. Okay, that's fine. So, let me rephrase it a little bit differently. Isn't the very existence of U.S. law being so powerfully in favor of speech a pushback against the notion that we shouldn't expect as much from this regime as perhaps people like Professor Chander and others might? Is that clear?
Yeah, I mean, what I want to clarify is that CDA 230 right now does not get exported to other countries by the U.S.
Well, right. Well, no, that's fair, and that's a fair point. I guess by export, I mean that we have, as a country, attempted
right,
to suggest that
about free speech,
right, and that other countries should follow our lead. But you're right. No, to be clear, no, Section 230 is not part of international law.
Sorry. So I think what is really interesting about this is that, and this again goes to why my focus is on the USTR as opposed to other parts of the U.S. is that we send a really mixed message internationally, right? So the U.S. Talks big game about free speech internationally and talks big game about supporting the kinds of business models that we have in Silicon Valley internationally. But when it comes to the hard law that we are making through international trade, we are making hard law that benefits other industries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the players in Silicon Valley and the public interest groups that speak sometimes in alignment with those players because of mutual free speech issues are not participating in the making of international law through trade.
Mm-hmm. So let's get to another kind that related to this, another concept that you introduced in the article I think is really interesting, this idea of regulatory paraphrasing.
Jargon.
Yes, jargon, exactly. But I think, you're right. I mean, I think you're implying there is some jargon that may not be that useful, but I think this is actually very useful. And you're speaking to a good person on this because I teach contracts, and so I have a particular interest in how we use words to make agreements. So tell us about your idea of regulatory paraphrasing and what it means in this context.
Right. So having bad information flow or asymmetric information flow into the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative would be completely ineffective if the USTR were just exporting U.S. law. Mm-hmm. So if the job of the USTR were to take U.S. statutes and hand them to other countries and say, this is what you need to do, there would be no room for the kinds of distortions that I find interesting and that are creating problems in this process. So the reason that I figured out this was going on is because I was spending a good amount of time in the weeds looking at the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement text and the leaked proposal for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Mm-hmm. And in looking at those texts, I noticed, as a number of other people, mainly in public interest groups, have noticed, that the language wasn't really U.S. law. There were a number of places where it looked like how you would read U.S. digital copyright law if you were an attorney for the RIAA. and oddly enough, when, you know, I started looking at this more systematically, I saw that this kind of brilliant thing is going on there, like with all due respect to the people who are involved with this, where the USTR is pushed by the advisory committees to make changes in U.S. law through a paraphrasing process. So regulatory paraphrasing is what I use to describe what the USTR does when it's exporting law. Mm-hmm. It looks at regulations, it looks at statutes, it looks at judge-made law, and then it paraphrases them and offers them to other countries. What the paper is most concerned about is what happens when that process of regulatory paraphrasing gets captured.
And so that paraphrasing idea becoming central, and by the way, I should now say as a caveat, Margo, we're now at what I call the unfair portion of the show. And this is where I start asking you questions that you don't, may not have time to answer in the time that we have left, but I ask them anyway because it's my show. So that's pretty much, there's no nicer way to put it. So this idea of paraphrasing, right, combined with capture seems particularly problematic. But you in the article, right, despite being a realist, I think you also, at least the way I read your position, is that there are ways to deal with this, right? So in the remaining, you know, nine, ten minutes that we have, let's talk a little bit about that. If you were to, I'm going to put you in the role now, it sounds like law professor stuff, but I'll put you in the role of the person who can wave the proverbial magic wand and make one process change. And we'll talk about substance in a moment, but really a procedural change in order to get at this problem of capture and regulatory paraphrasing. If there was one magic solution, put aside whether it's politically feasible or what have you, but if you're going to solve the problem, what do you do?
You apply the Federal Advisory Committee Act to the USTR.
Okay, and so what, go ahead, yeah, please.
Yeah, and this was, you know, the amazing thing about doing research in this was realizing that the problem I was observing had a solution that was proposed in the 1960s. And for whatever reason, Congress in the 1970s decided to exempt the USTR from that solution. Mm-hmm. So the Federal Advisory Committee Act, again, as I mentioned earlier, it has transparency requirements so that the interaction between the USTR and its advisory committees would be made public. The texts would be made public of whatever it's showing, USTR is showing to these advisory committees. And the advisory committees themselves would have to have balanced membership, and they could only exist for a shorter amount of time. And all of these things were put into place by Congress in the Federal Advisory Committee Act because they feared capture of domestic agencies by a fifth branch of government of industry advisory groups.
Uh-huh. And so now I'll give you the pushback position, and it's one that you're familiar with, as am I, right? So the response to that might be, well, if you do that, right, you change the nature of negotiation, right? And more specifically, right, and this is, there's a history of this as well, trade is different, right? And diplomacy is different. So how do you respond to that? I mean, again, recognizing the time constraints, how do you respond to that pushback argument?
So I think that the weight is now on other people, predominantly the people who are defending that position, to explain why trade is different. Mm-hmm. Because we allow for advisory committees that are governed by this law in the State Department, and we might not let those advisory committees read drafts of treaties before the treaty drafts are officially made public, but then we also don't allow them the kind of input into the process that these advisory committees have with the USTR. Mm-hmm. So I guess my answer to that is, you know, trade may be different, but it's not different with respect to the relationship with industry that every other administrative agency, you know, is potentially has. Mm-hmm. And so at least with respect to its relationship with industry, you either get to use your advisory committees and get the full amount of protection against corruption, or you don't get to have your advisory committees.
So if we, if and again, I want to play this out. So if we have FACA, okay, this and again, this more open, more inclusive advisory and input process for lawmaking actually happening, what does that mean on the ground for a U.S. citizen? Right, so not the U.S. citizen who's happens to be an expert in trade, or the U.S. citizen who has such a strong position with regard to copyright infringement that they're going to write letters and do that stuff. I'm just talking about the person using the internet. What is the and I'll ask you the best case scenario. What is the best case scenario in your view, realistic but best case scenario for imposing a process like that on international trade intellectual property law negotiations?
The best case scenario is that this allows for both oversight by and participation by other voices in intellectual property. So those other voices that I'm referring to are a combination of Silicon Valley firms, again, whose interests sometimes align with users on free speech, and public interest groups whose interests tend to align more with users on both speech and privacy, which is another piece of the puzzle that's missing that we haven't discussed. So if you're an average internet user, and you recognize the fact, as, again, Anupam wisely points out, that the internet is global, and that your online experience in large part is dictated by the laws of other countries, you don't want to have your government participate in putting laws in place in other countries that don't consider privacy or speech values. So the best case scenario is by revising this totally obscure law, you get oversight and participation by people who will ensure that those values go into place in the laws that govern the global internet.
So as you know, and I should have mentioned earlier, so Jeremy Malcolm from Consumers International, right, has done work here. And in fact, Jeremy was on the show quite a while ago now at this point, but he did an interesting study with which I know you're familiar that looked at other international institutions, right, and their level of transparency. And as you pointed out briefly earlier, generally speaking, all other international institutions, right, that have been involved in these issues have been more transparent, meaning they've made texts available earlier, or they've had notice and comment periods, or some other way the public's been allowed to input. Just by way of, again, playing with this solution, is it a solution in your mind to simply take something like TPP, right, which, again, to be clear, is being negotiated now in a roughly standardless world, or if there are standards, the standards are based on, as I mentioned earlier, traditional concepts of what diplomacy and negotiation looks like, and move them into WIPO, or move them into some other institution that has rules and regulations and norms with regard to transparency and input and capture and so forth? What do you say to that?
I think that would solve many of the problems, but I think U.S. citizens in particular should be concerned about the idea that we have to go to a different international forum in order to have the kind of democratic participation and accountability that we want to have and should have at home.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you move the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement into a different regime, you move it to the UN or you move it to the World Trade Organization, it would make it easier for public interest groups, Silicon Valley firms, whatever other, I haven't even mentioned the access to medicines community, who are often working in the space as well. It would make it easier for those people to have access to what ends up in these agreements, but the idea that they have to route around the U.S. portion of this process and go to an international forum in order to participate is really, really problematic. So I still think that's kind of a second best solution, and the real focus should be on trying to fix what's happening at home.
So, Margo, let me, and we're coming into about two more minutes, so let me ask you this very quick, short question. I asked you the ideal situation. Now I'm going to ask you, because you identify yourself as very practical, practically speaking, right, what would you expect the impact of this, of these kinds of solutions, to be on the process?
Yeah, I should also point out I was being so practical, I didn't give you the real ideal solutions, which would be, to have transparency,
right,
full public transparency in addition to participation mechanisms.
Yep.
So my much more practical answer is that I think transparency is still the really difficult elephant in the room here. And I think that because of trade's history and in large part because of how Congress thinks about trade, we're really unlikely to get full transparency about negotiating documents, as much as that hurts me to say that. Mm-hmm. But if we can try to start fixing the advisory committee process by allowing for input by a diverse variety of representatives, instead of just one side of the IP debates, and if we can also get Congress to put some negotiating mandates in that tell USTR what you're doing is really not okay, you need to consider these other things, then we are several steps closer to a solution to this problem. And I just wanted, one thing that was really interesting to me was that this debate actually played out in the 1990s with environmentalism. So you had environmentalists who said trade negotiations are undemocratic, they're not transparent, we're really concerned about the kind of law that's being made, it's being made in the favor of a number of industries, and we don't have any participation in this process. And so the executive branch unilaterally created an advisory committee that's an environmental law advisory committee. And Congress put into play a number of requirements that the USTR has to consider environmental law. So something similar for the internet, which, like the environment, is a public good that faces collective action problems, would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, we're pretty much out of time here, but it does, as you mentioned, that does remind me of the work of Jamie Boyle and others, right, talking about cultural environmentalism, which of course has a long history in IP as well. And you're absolutely right to point out this issue of patents, which is often forgotten, or at least becomes secondary because so much of the focus has been on copyright. And I think patents, in that sense, copyright perhaps is more developed in terms of thinking about these issues than patents, which historically have been, I think, viewed as more transparent by virtue of the process by which one gets a patent. But we're going to have to leave that topic, I think, for another day, when I invite you back on the show. One last question for you, Margo. As I mentioned in the introduction, right, your article, The Cabinet of International Intellectual Property Law through the U.S. Trade Regime, has been accepted for publication by USC's Law Review, recognizing that law review processes are vary from time to time, and editing processes can take time. Do you have a sense of when the article will be available for public distribution? And if you don't, that's okay too.
Right. Yeah. The article is going to be published in May of 2014, but I will likely have an earlier version up by, I'd say, December or January of this year.
Very good. And when you say up, where will it be available?
On SSRN.
Excellent, excellent. Margo Kaminsky, research scholar in law and executive director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. Like I said, I'm a fan of your work. I think this is a terrific contribution to the growing question of how international law is made in this area. Thank you for joining us on the show. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much again.
My pleasure. So I'm happy to mention a number of guests that are coming up on the show as we continue through this fall quarter on Hearsay Culture. Coming up next week, Professor Victoria Stodden of Columbia University, followed by Denise Howell, the host of This Week in Law, a podcast that I'm a huge fan of. Then Chris Sprigman of New York University discussing NSA spying, and Dan Nazer of the Electronic Freedom Foundation, Electronic Frontier Foundation, discussing issues involving patent trolls or non-practicing entities and patent law more broadly. Lastly, in rounding out the quarter on December 4th, we will have show number 200, which I will be announcing more details about in the coming week or two. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The first is live on KZSU Wednesdays at 4 o'clock Pacific time by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu or listening in the Bay Area. Or you can listen via podcast by going to either the Hearsay Culture website, where you can get all previous 190 plus shows, or you can even get the show by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society, or by going to the website for the Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by going to or emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So, thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.